This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Her Ojibwe name translates as Woman of the Sound the Stars Make Rushing Through the Sky. Her English name, Jane Johnson Schoolcraft, a poet who also wrote down and translated Ojibwe stories and songs. Her work inspired Longfellow. On the program today, we're going to talk about her life and life's work with University of Illinois English professor Robert Dale Parker. Professor Parker is the editor of a book of Jane Johnson Schoolcraft's writings, the title, The Sound the Stars Make Rushing Through the Sky. Listeners, I invite you to join our conversation this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number. It's good anywhere in the continental U.S. Toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Robert Dale Parker is a professor of English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's the author of several books, including The Invention of Native American Literature. The book we'll talk about this afternoon, The Sound the Stars Make Rushing Through the Sky, The Writings of Jane Johnson Schoolcraft, is published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Good afternoon. Welcome. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you, Celeste. It's great to be here.
How did your interest in Native American literature begin?
Some people, when they ask that question, want to hear that I grew up near a reservation or something like that. I didn't. I actually am from Illinois, of all places, where there are no reservations, though there are a lot of Indian people living in Illinois. But my interest in American Indian literature came because I was a scholar of American literature and noticed that scholars of American literature weren't paying much attention to American Indian literature, and I thought that we should. So I started reading. And when I read, I found that what I read was fascinating and kept reading and started to teach, and it got more and more interesting, and it grew from there.
And what was your introduction to the writings of Jane Johnson Schoolcraft?
There's a story behind that, a story that goes back many years. She was not a well-known, or is not a well-known figure at all, and she didn't publish, though some of her works were published without her name being connected to them. She was born in 1800, and she lived in Sault Ste. Marie, way north in Michigan, where the winters are 5 months long on a good winter. And one winter in 1826 and 1827, her husband, and we'll get to talk to him about him later, I'm sure, but her husband, getting bored with the long winter, decided to put together a magazine. Now, they didn't have any printing presses, of course, and so he had someone, we don't know who, write out by hand a magazine so that they could pass it around among their friends and relatives. And nobody paid any attention to that for many years until in 1962 somebody transcribed and published the magazine. And it's mostly materials by her husband Henry, and it's a real grab bag jumble of all different kinds of things. But mixed in there are some writings by Jane Johnson Schoolcraft without her name on them. And in the last few years, as scholars have studied American Indian literature, they started to notice these works a little bit. And so they were in bibliographies, and sometimes people had them even in reference books, mentioned in reference books. And I looked at them just because I was trying to look at all the Indian literature that I could find, especially earlier Indian literature. And I got suspicious. I looked at it, and I thought, I bet she wrote more than was here. So I started digging.
Yeah. And surprise, surprise, there was more.
One surprise after another.
Yeah.
For every 1,000 haystacks you look in, you find a needle. So it takes a lot of work, but it was exciting to come upon these writings.
Yeah, really a detective story.
I think of it that way. I'm glad that you do. It's taken following hunches, such as just suspecting that there were more works. Fortunately, her husband, Henry, who was a pretty unsavory figure in a lot of ways that we may get a chance to talk about, was also a saver.
Yeah.
So he saved her writings amongst the thousands and thousands and thousands of his other documents that he obsessively kept, and so many of them survived.
Yeah. In the Library of Congress, his papers include 25,000 items.
25,000. And my guess is that's only about half of the total number in other libraries around the world and across the country. So wow. That's been a big job to look through them.
Well, as I read The Sound the Stars Make Rushing Through the Sky, I felt real mixed feelings about Henry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because on the one hand, we have her work because of him.
Yes.
On the other hand, he wasn't really good about paying heed mm-hmm, or paying mm-hmm. Attribution.
Yes, and really that's just a small part of the larger historical consequence. He's a famous figure. Henry wrote Schoolcraft, and if you look across a map or travel or live in much of Wisconsin and Michigan and Minnesota, you'll find that there are a lot of places named after Henry Schoolcraft. Towns, schools, counties, stores, and if they're not named after him, they're probably named by him. But I hope that this book will change things so that before long, he will not be Schoolcraft, she will be. Jane Johnston Schoolcraft will be Schoolcraft. And the issue was that he was the federal American Indian agent for the Michigan Territory, which at that point included what's now Michigan and Wisconsin and much of Minnesota, sometimes more vaguely parts of Indiana and Illinois. In other words, a whole lot of the upper Midwest and a vast area. And he was, in effect, responsible for supervising the American colonization of Indian people and forcing treaties upon people to get their land. And his, in effect, theft of the land is not unrelated, let's say, to his theft of the stories of Indian people, which he published under his name, saying that they were Indian stories, but not really making clear where he got them, how he got them, that he depended on his wife, Jane, and her family, and many other Indian people, especially Ojibwe people, for those stories and for many of the books that made him famous as a founder of American anthropology.
Mm. Well, let's talk about Jane. What did she write about?
Yes. She wrote about many of the things that many other American women poets and British women poets of the time wrote about. She wrote about the outdoors. She was a gardener. She wrote about gardens. She wrote about islands and flowers. And she wrote about her children. Like so many women of the time, she suffered the early death and unexpected death of a child, and she wrote a lot of poems about that. She also wrote stories. She's the first person we know of to write down traditional Indian stories, and also she wrote translations of a variety of Indian materials, Ojibwe in particular, but especially songs.
Hmm. Would you share an example of her writing with us?
Sure. We were suggesting that people might like to hear a poem written about an island in Lake Superior that she called Castle Island, though it didn't really have a name. I had to search for a while to find out what island this would be. It's near Marquette, Michigan, on the southern shore of Lake Superior. And this poem, actually, she wrote in Ojibwe. She's also the first known American Indian to write in poetry in an Indian language. But this is an English translation that she left. Here in my native inland sea, from pain and sickness would I flee, and from its shores and island bright gather a store of sweet delight. Lone island of the saltless sea, how wide, how sweet, how fresh and free, how all-transporting is the view of rocks and skies and waters blue, uniting as a song's sweet strains to tell, here nature only reigns. Ah, nature, here forever sway, far from the haunts of men away, for here there are no sordid fears, no crimes, no misery, no tears, no pride of wealth, the heart to fill, no laws to treat my people ill. Now she's writing at a time when the American government was starting to impose its laws, to impose its authority, to force her people to sign a treaty and then another treaty and another treaty. And the complication, of course, is that then her husband mm-hmm. became the official representative of that government, so she was torn on both sides.
Yeah. And that poem dates from 1838?
Yes. Yes. and she died just 4 years later in 1842. She was actually visiting the island for her health, trying to recover. She was sick most of her life, so it was a struggling life that she lived, and that comes across in a lot of the poems. A lot of the poems are just about being sad or missing her husband when he traveled, or missing family members when they died.
Yeah. She wrote in Ojibwe. She wrote in English. Did she also write in French?
There's one little piece that I found in French that seems to be almost a holiday lark to write for fun in French. Where she grew up, there were no other English speakers apart from her family. Her father was born in Ireland, and her mother was Ojibwe and from what's now northern Wisconsin. So she grew up in an Ojibwe-speaking home where her father also spoke English and her siblings learned English. And the only other white people around besides her father were French-speaking, except for the occasional fur trader who would come traveling through. So she learned to write like this, even though she had relatively little exposure to other English-speaking people, except when she traveled away from Sault Ste. Marie. It's a remarkable story. Her father, a fur trader, just happened to love books and collected over 1,000 volumes in an area that to white people was the middle of nowhere. It was the center of Ojibwe culture in Sault Ste. Marie. But this is a remarkable story that someone could gather a library like that, raise his children with a magnificent English language education, especially her. She was his favorite. And yet, at the same time, they had an elite and sophisticated Ojibwe education and were thoroughly immersed in Ojibwe culture.
Yeah, and her father wrote poetry as well, right?
Not as well as his daughter, but
well,
he did.
Well, not as well, but I meant in addition to it.
He did. He did. Yeah. There's a wonderful story when he first came out fur trading where he's out there in what's now northern Wisconsin and the winter, the long winter has come on, and the voyageurs who rode him there deserted him, and he's all alone, and he writes a poem comparing himself to Robinson Crusoe in 1792 in the starving winter.
What was life like in Sault Ste. Marie in the 19th century, early 19th century?
It was centered around snow. It was centered around fish, white fish in particular. It was a great place for white fish. It still is, though I doubt as good as it was then. And it varied seasonally so that large numbers of Ojibwe people would gather in the spring, and it would be a center for people to come through from all around the Ojibwe Great Lakes country. And so she grew up, Jane Johnston Schoolcraft grew up with that as part of her heritage. Her family was also very influential. Her grandfather was still a famous war chief from, again, what's now northern Wisconsin. His name was Wabajig. And her mother and father settled there as fur traders. And then her mother's family members also came and joined them, so that her uncle, for example, her uncle Weshki, is a founding figure of one of the major Indian communities that's there today, the Bay Mills Indian community. And it's very exciting for people around there who've grown up as part of this heritage to have these writings, previously mostly unknown, brought to earth.
Yeah, what? Tell us more about that.
She's long been known to especially people in the area because her family is so famous on both sides of her family, the Ojibwe side and her father's side. And in fact, two of her houses are still there and are National Historic Landmarks in Sault Ste. Marie. But the attention goes to her father, somewhat to her mother, to her famous husband as well, and she's just been seen as a figure in the background, almost an exotic frosting to the rest of this story. I think that will change now.
Yeah. What is known about what her mother was like?
Her mother is described almost exactly the same way by every traveler who went through and left an account, and many of them did, and it's remarkable that their accounts all sound alike, so there's a lot of consensus here. She was deeply admired by everyone who knew her. It's remarkable, it seems to me, that people who write in English and didn't speak Ojibwe left these admiring accounts from her, even though they couldn't speak with her in English because she would not speak English. So she stuck to her Ojibwe heritage with great loyalty. She was a physically strong woman, a very active woman, traveled a lot within the area, was perfectly comfortable jumping in a canoe and canoeing across the St. Mary's River to Canada to see friends and relatives there, and was famous for the amount of maple sugar that she would harvest each spring, enormous amounts that would fill a sizable room each year. I had to double-check the amounts because people refused to believe it at first. I forget how many tons, but quite a lot. And also an important figure diplomatically. When the Americans came in 1820 and they brought troops and they said, "You have to sign a treaty," the Ojibwe leaders weren't too happy about that. And she convinced them that they had to sign or else there would be war. This is a vexed legacy because, of course, as people, Ojibwe people today remember that, they see it as a turning point in the loss of their land, and yet it also kept peace. So she's a complicated figure in that way with multiple loyalties. Her name was Ojogoskarawekwe. Her husband renamed her Susan, and she eventually converted to Christianity and tried very much to live in both worlds. It was a time when what we now think of as both worlds really were not two separate worlds, a time and a place now lost, where the idea of there being a separate red world and a separate white world didn't have the kind of currency that it did today. Recent historians have called this the middle ground, where people really could live in a world that was of both races. And that's something that Jane Johnston Schoolcraft was born in and lived in, and in some ways represents the passing of, because as the Americans came, they wanted to see things as white versus red instead of white and red. And that changed the Midwest.
Now, Jane Johnston Schoolcraft's grandfather, Susan's mother, Susan's father,
Wabajig,
did not want his daughter to marry John Johnson. What can you tell us about that? Eventually, of course, they did marry.
Yes. Well, there had been fur traders, white fur traders, coming through since the late 17th century. At first, they were mostly French, and then gradually they were more often English. And they often married or lived with Indian women, and most of them didn't stay loyal to the women that they lived with or married. Some did. Wabajig's sister had married a white trader, and that seems to have broken up. And so he had seen the sadness that could come. He knew that the traders would come, they would take what they could get, and then they would leave. And so he feared that that would be the case with John Johnston. So he said, "Well, you can go back to Montreal," and which is a canoe trip roughly the length of traveling by canoe from New York City to Miami, Florida. He said, "You can go back to Montreal, and if you come back next year, then you can marry her." And I'm sure he thought that that would be the end of it. But John Johnston did come back. And this marriage was not a willing marriage on Ojogoskarawekwe's part. But by all accounts, it became a very happy marriage after she made the adjustment, which had to be very difficult.
Yeah. And the children were raised in both worlds.
Yes. Yes.
This goes back to the idea of middle ground, would it?
Absolutely. For them, it wasn't two worlds. It was the world they lived in.
Yeah.
It was not exotic to them. It was the way the Midwest was, this part of the Midwest as well.
What were attitudes toward women in this place and time and in the Johnson family?
That's a really important question. And maybe one way to get at that would be to tell the story briefly of a famous American writer who some of the listeners will know about, named Margaret Fuller, who visited Mackinac Island a little after Jane Johnston Schoolcraft died. And Jane Johnston Schoolcraft had been living at Mackinac just a few years before. And she looked around, as white tourists often did, and she looked at Indian women through the eyes and expectations of an East Coast white American. And she thought, "Oh, the women are so oppressed. They're drudges." This was the cliche amongst white people. And what a terrible life it must be for Ojibwe women. Well, she didn't get to meet Schoolcraft, who had just died, but Schoolcraft's friend said to her, It really isn't like that. Jane Schoolcraft thought that Ojibwe women had it better than white women. And this was a revelation to Margaret Fuller and required her to rethink her ideas about how white people understood the position of women. It was hard for whites to understand because women did labor that whites expected from white men. They did farming. They were conspicuous as workers in the home in a way that upper middle class white women were not. But they also had, according to many accounts, and of course there's a legacy of this that continues in some ways today, they were in a position of great respect and responsibility, and just along different lines from the way whites expected it.
Hmm. What were John Johnson's expectations for his daughters?
That's a good question. It seems that he expected them to marry white men. This was a prejudicial world, by all means. And while his sons found it hard to have choices and marry anyone they would have wanted because of the way Indian men were looked down on, Indian women were exoticized and romanticized, especially well-educated Indian women. And Jane Johnson Schoolcraft was not the only one. And so, and also there were almost no white women around. So as white men came, if they wanted to join with Indian women, then only Indian women were available. So that was an option, and it seems that he expected her to move more in the white direction, though I'm sure not to leave the Indian direction behind. He himself, very unusual for a trader, was of noble heritage in Ireland. At first, I was skeptical of this. I thought maybe he was just making up a story about himself and inflating it. But it's true. And his family was very distinguished in Ireland. And he looked for that as a possibility. In fact, he brought Jane with him to Ireland at one point when she was 9 years old, thinking that he might leave her there with his sister. She was miserable. She hated it and was delighted some months later finally to come back to her mother in Sault Ste. Marie.
Very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is University of Illinois Professor of English Robert Dale Parker. We're talking with him this afternoon about Jane Johnson Schoolcraft. Professor Parker is the editor of The Sound the Stars Make Rushing Through the Sky, the writings of Jane Johnson Schoolcraft. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, your comments for our guest. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. So when did Jane begin writing?
It's hard to say for sure, but the earliest manuscript that has a date on it is from 1815, when she was just 15 years old.
Very interesting. Just 15. She shared her father's love for literature.
Mm-hmm.
So what kinds of things would they read?
A lot of things that are forgotten today. She read lots of history, lots of theology, all the famous dramatists of the 18th century, certainly all of Shakespeare, and there are wonderful references to Shakespeare in her letters and notes with Henry, especially during their courtship, when they would use references to Shakespeare to flirt with each other. She also read lots of poets who were famous then and forgotten now, as well as all those who are now famous. Certainly in later years, she read that scandal, Byron, and she read Cooper. She was particularly fond of Oliver Goldsmith, whom some of your listeners might have read if they took a lot of English courses. And so she read those things that we know and many things that we've now forgotten.
Hmm. How did she come to be married to Henry Roe Schoolcraft?
He came as the representative of the federal government in 1822, and he moved in with the Johnstons. That's what all visitors did. They were the leading family, and they would host people. And she was the most eligible young woman in town, and he was the most eligible white young man in town. And one thing apparently led to another.
Hmm. Her stories were a key source for Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's The Song of Hiawatha. But Longfellow didn't know Jane was the source.
Isn't that a great story? All these years, people have known, because Longfellow acknowledged it, that Longfellow took most of the stories of the Song of Hiawatha and some of his other works from Henry Schoolcraft's recordings of Indian stories. But nobody thought to go into Henry Schoolcraft's manuscripts, where a lot of the stories appear in earlier versions before Henry got his fingers on them and edited them, written down by Jane Schoolcraft and sometimes by her little brother William as well. And so a lot of the stories that Longfellow depended on for the most famous poem in American history come from Jane Johnston Schoolcraft and her family.
Now, would she have been aware of that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. I check. Her husband was aware of it, but she didn't live long enough to be aware of it.
Oh.
In fact, Henry, as typical of him, tried to profit from it, tried to come out with a new edition of his books now that it was famous because of Longfellow.
Yeah. He had some strengths and weaknesses in
yes.
his ethnography, mm-hmm. His practice of ethnography.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I think we've got a listener who wants to talk with you on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm wondering if the Schoolcraft, who was the Indian agent, had such an influence on Henry Wadsworth's poem Hiawatha, was in relation to the Schoolcraft that you're talking about?
Oh, yes, that's the same one.
The same one.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
You're very welcome. Other telephone calls are invited this afternoon. Questions, comments, 333-9455. Anywhere else outside the Champaign-Urbana area, you can call us toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, would Jane have been familiar with Longfellow's earlier work?
His earliest, I can't actually remember the dates when his first poems, that's a good question, when his first poems became famous. If they overlapped, then she probably would have. She moved to New York after he was fired partly for corruption in 1841 and did start to meet the other writers of the day.
Okay. Again, what were the dates of her?
She died in 1842.
1842.
Was born in 1800.
Okay. And Evangeline would have been 1840s?
I don't have the date in my head, but I think it's after 1842.
Yeah, okay, very interesting.
About 1849, something like that.
Yeah. You say early in the book, I believe, that her work has largely been ignored by historians. In your words, they understood it as a mere curiosity or as the silly habit of a foolish woman.
Well, when I say historians in that sense, I'm speaking generally of those several almost unknown historians who happened to have come across her manuscripts while they were looking for what they considered important in Henry's manuscripts.
Mm-hmm.
The men's stuff was what counted. But these are obscure historians, and only they have even seen his work, her work.
Yeah. Had they also discounted her work because she was an Indian?
Oh, absolutely. It just wasn't interesting. It wasn't important from the perspective they were looking from.
Mm. Would you like to share another example of her work with
us? Sure. Since we just looked at a poem a little while ago, why don't we look at a translation of a song? This is one of my favorites, and it's good for this time of year. It's called Song of the Acogas, or Frog in Spring. And while I think some readers will be tempted to hear this as a poem about white people, it's a poem, or at least a song, presents itself as a frog singing in the spring, remember the long winters in Sault Ste. Marie, and lamenting that the snow hasn't melted yet, and eager for the spring to come and melt the snow. And the Ojibwe word for spring at the end of this short, just nine-line poem is seguin. So this is Song of the Acogas, or Frog in Spring. See how the white spirit presses us heavy and long, presses us down to the frost-bitten earth. Alas, you are heavy, ye spirits, so white. Alas, you are cold. You are cold, you are cold. Ah, cease, shining spirits that fell from the skies. Ah, cease to crush us and keep us in dread. Ah, when will ye vanish and Seguin return? Now, one of the things that makes that so listenable today, I think, is that it's a literal translation. Some of the other translations, including one of this poem or song, that are in rhyme and meter sound a little funny to our 21st century ears, but would have sounded better in 19th century ears.
That's really interesting as well, because here we have, at once we have a woman from the 19th century who is sounding really like she would could walk among us and work among us, and her work would be acknowledged today.
I think so, but of course she would write very differently if she wrote today.
Sure.
Her poems would be different.
Sure.
They wouldn't be in rhyme and meter.
Yeah. Well, what do you think an awareness of her work is going to contribute to American literary history and American Indian literary history?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that's a great question. It changes a lot. It lengthens the story, for one thing. And particularly, I think, in American ideas of Indian people, including sometimes among Indian people themselves, underestimate the literacy of Indian people, both in the present and historically. And this can help undermine that myth of Indian people as not literate. So that's one key element here, and it's part of what drove me to this research. Another is that we have a history of American poetry that tends to focus, at least in early American literature, still tends to focus on the writing of white men. And important as that is, it helps us understand what was being written if we see the wider range and the dialogue between writers of different backgrounds, which I think is really interesting here, as you indicate, with Longfellow drawing on Schoolcraft and Schoolcraft reading other writers of her time. Also, the way she recorded such a wide range and wrote such a wide range of materials, from traditional Indian stories that draw on the same kinds of interests, for example, that the Grimms were drawing on as they recorded stories from Europe, to the poems that she wrote about family and friends and nature, and the work in rhyme and meter that is not storytelling, to the translations of songs. It gives a sense of a breadth of daily life lived in a literate way that doesn't fit our images of early American women, of early American Indian people, or of the Midwest. Mm. And it gives us, therefore, a much more complicated racial picture of the Midwest as well.
Yeah. What did Henry Schoolcraft think of his wife's gifts?
He seems to have been proud of her, but sometimes in a condescending way. He looks at her as someone who can prove that Indian people are intelligent. Yes, that's helpful, but it's also proving something that shouldn't need to be proven. He has a record of a visit they made to New York in 1825, where he describes the pride he took when other people met her. And he almost sounds like a horse salesman, showing off a horse's teeth. He brags about her handwriting, and he brags about how people like to look at her. But he says that they looked at her as the Northern Pocahontas. So that shows that he's still a prisoner to the cliches of Indian people, mm-hmm. even as he's trying to break out of them.
Mm. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon. Is there a caller there on line one? Let's go to the next line there. Line two.
Hello?
Hi there.
Hi. I called with a comment.
Okay.
I'm the caller on line one. I got disconnected somehow.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to say that even though Indian peoples did not know how to read or write, some of them did, of course, but many did not, but they still had a wonderful oral tradition that they passed down from generations.
Yes, and that's very important, and it's part of what Jane Johnston Schoolcraft recorded for us in the stories that she wrote. I would hope that we can take the recognize the importance of what you're saying and recognize the literacy at once. Sometimes I think we've allowed one to help us overlook the other. So I think your comment is really important, and I hope that we can bring that together with a sense of the history of Indian literacy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Would you like to share with us a story?
Sure. I'll read a short one since we're on the radio, and I think your listeners will enjoy this one. It's, let's see here. Let me get the page.
When you find it, and I will reintroduce us here.
Okay.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Robert Dale Parker is our guest this afternoon. He's the editor of The Sound the Stars Make Rushing Through the Sky, the writings of Jane Johnston Schoolcraft.
This little story, just one paragraph, is called The Three Cranberries. And this is actually one that Henry did publish, and unlike the others, he didn't change this one too much from what she actually wrote. But it's not very well known. The Three Cranberries. Three cranberries were living in a lodge together. One was green, one white, and one red. They were sisters. There was snow on the ground, and as the men were absent, they felt afraid and began to say to each other, "What shall we do if the wolf comes?" "I," said the green one, "will climb up a shingup tree." A spruce tree. A shingup tree. "I," said the white one, "will hide myself in the kettle of boiled hominy." "And I," said the red one, "will conceal myself under the snow." Presently the wolves came, and each one did as she had said. But only one of the three had judged wisely. The wolves immediately ran to the kettle and ate up the corn, and with it the white cranberry. The red one was trampled to pieces by their feet, and her blood spotted the snow. But she, who had climbed the thick spruce tree, escaped notice and was saved. Now, that story is both cute and scary at the same time. The cuteness protects us from the scariness. Some of the other stories that aren't about cranberries but are about people that are probably too long to read on the radio but are scary all the way through or tell the story of how something began, where robins came from, where corn comes from. And so they evoke part of the items that were central in the daily life of the Ojibwe people.
Hmm. What were her final years like?
They were hard. They were hard. Henry moved her away from Sault Ste. Marie, and leaving her mother was very hard. And that's all through her letters, missing her mother and often going back to visit her mother when she could. And then Henry was caught up in corruption scandals and fought with some of her relatives, and it put a lot of pressure on her, plus that she was sick all the time. And then when he lost his job, she moved all the way to New York, and that was very hard. The other thing that made it hard is that Henry insisted that their children go to Eastern boarding schools, and that was a terrible loss to her, and she wrote about that, too.
Yeah, she did write about that, and that's a heart. This breaks your heart, that part of the story. And Henry, in the end, he was he exonerated from his disgrace, or
he got off, let's say. Yeah. Exoneration might be putting it a little too strongly, though he liked to say he was exonerated. It was a time when government officials were pretty open about corruption, and then that was starting to change, and he was caught in the middle. That's the kindest way to put it.
Yeah. There are some questions, of course, you've not been able to answer in your research. What would you like most to know?
What a good question. What would I like most to know? I would like to know what else she wrote that we probably have lost. I would like to know more about how she felt as she saw the troops coming and knew that her life would change forever. we see her struggling with that change. We see her writing about it in one poem, for example, how now when she wakes up, she looks over in the morning and she sees the star flag rising each morning. And she feels, as she puts it in that poem, she feels half joy and half fear as she welcomes the proud republic here. But I would like to know more about that.
Yeah. Besides the items, the papers of Henry Rowe Schoolcraft in the Library of Congress, there are papers in Springfield.
I would have traveled anywhere in the world to find these papers, and then I find they're sitting in Springfield, and they had been there for at least 125 years, and no one knows how they got there. They were in the Illinois State Library, which has since been absorbed into the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, the new library there, and they had been sitting in a box for as long as anyone knows until coincidentally the week before I looked.
Wow. How is it, you know, that there happens to be boxes like that in places, and things just remain in boxes?
Well, I think we need to fund our libraries more. That's simply what it comes down to. Libraries can't afford to catalog everything. Sometimes they know about what they have that isn't cataloged, and I tried to contact all those libraries that might have such things, but there might be some other boxes sitting around somewhere.
Yeah. Are there other American Indian writings coming to light now?
Oh, yes. But they tend to be autobiographical or historical. They don't, from this early on, we haven't found other people writing poetry or even very much stories, and that's part of what makes this special.
Yeah. So again, would you talk with us a little bit about what it's been like for you piecing this story together?
For me, well, I haven't thought about that. It's been fun. It's been challenging. It also comes with a sense of responsibility, because this isn't the thing that English professors usually do, is they generate their own ideas about other people's writing. Well, that's part of this project, but this also comes with a responsibility to represent a much vaster history, and that's a challenge, and it keeps me humble.
Mm. Let's take one more call. Listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Bob. I wanted to say something because you spent all this time discovering this woman's work, and you understand her. And I think people who read this stuff and hear about your quest, it brings into focus that there are thousands, if not millions, of indigenous people who had similar thoughts, but were never able to give permanent voice to them in terms of written language.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, to me, that's one of the biggest things that I come away from hearing about Schoolcraft.
That's a really important point. And if I can just supplement that by saying that there are probably many also who did write, but they didn't have a saver saving their works, or we just haven't found them yet. So I hope that as this access that we now have to Jane Johnson Schoolcraft's work can remind us of what you've just said, that these same kinds of thoughts were shared by millions of other indigenous peoples around the world and across the North, South, and Central Americas, that it can also encourage us to find what was left by those who did write, where it may have survived.
Mm. One,
yes.
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I think it's like listening to lost or silent voices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know that Anne Frank wrote her diaries, and I know that there were thousands of Native people, girls, who experienced the same fears and contemplations and came to adjust to whatever happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I really appreciate your work and looking into that.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. And one last question I'd like to ask before wrapping up here, or as we wrap up. Would you say her name in Ojibwe for us?
Sure. Bamawawa Gazekakwe.
It's a beautiful name. And the translation is lovely.
I'm told it's a lyrical version of the translation, but a good translation.
Woman of the sound the stars make rushing through the sky. Robert Dale Parker, thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Robert Dale Parker is a professor of English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He is the author of a number of books. He is the editor now of The Sound the Stars Make Rushing Through the Sky, The Writings of Jane Johnson Schoolcraft. The book is published by the University of Pennsylvania Press.